Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Commonwealth Club. This program is part of the club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. I'm Kelly Corrigan, author of Tell Me More, Stories About the 12 Hardest Things I'm Learning to Say. I'm also the creative director and writer in residence for the Nantucket Project, and I am your moderator for today's program. It is now my pleasure to introduce Marcia Gay Harden, Academy and Tony Award-winning actress and author of this beautiful book about her mother, The Seasons of My Mother, a memoir of love, family, and flowers. You probably know this, but we'll say it just for fun. Some of the things Marcia has done, she's played Ava Gardner in Sinatra and artist Lee Krasner in Pollock, for which she won the Best Supporting Actress Oscar. And the Down and Out Celeste in Mystic River, which was gut-wrencher, which was also nominated for an Academy Award. She's done tons on television, including HBO's The Newsroom, which I watched every episode of, Damages on FX, and her current role, boy, I'm really blowing this. And I can write, but I can't read. In her current role on CBS's Code Black. And then she's had exceptional Broadway performances, including God of Carnage. Did you see that? So spectacular. Which garnered the Best Actress Tony Award in 2009. And today she's here to talk about her mother and her mother's Alzheimer's. So welcome, Marcia Gay Harden.
Thank you. Thank you, Kelly. Thank you. Thanks for being here.
Tell us about Beverly.
With pleasure. The book is called The Seasons of My Mother, and it's a book that chronicles the seasons of my mother's life. And my mother's name is Beverly Harden. She's a demure Dallas lady. The metaphor type of descriptions I can give you, mother always would say things like, if you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all. I wonder if anyone in the room recognizes themselves in that, which, by the way, I hated that phrase. I'd be like, no, you have to speak truth to power. Something's wrong. And, you know, later I learned that there was a great value in if you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all. My mother came from a family that wore pearls even in the daytime. There was just an elegance about her. My mother, when I was in college, my mother would still wear a slip with her blue jean skirt. And you'd be like, Ma, the whole point of the blue jean skirt is you don't have to wear a slip with it, Ma. Right? But so she had an elegance about her just as a lady. She came from a family that had beautiful antiques and chocolate pots and china, things that I don't have. My registry was Bed Bath and Beyond, you know. And she, when we lived in Japan, my dad was a military officer, and he was a naval officer. There's a wonderful story about him almost crashing into the Bay Bridge here. And then he was a young pilot in the Navy. So we can segue around, right?
Yeah, that's
today,
on my list of things to hear about.
But then she's like, Marcia Gay just segued in and out of every conversation.
But slow down.
Slow down.
Sir.
Slow down.
I got a plan for you.
Okay, I got it. So, can I tell him about my dad?
Can tell him about
So he was a pilot.
Thad.
In the Navy, and Thad was his name, and he was flying out over the Bay Bridge, and he lost an engine. And so the plane was hurtling toward the Bay Bridge, and he had to make a decision. Would he crash into the bridge and, you know, kill people on the bridge, or would he crash into the water and probably die? And he crashed into the water, and his training just jumped in, and he was able to, in sinking, get out of the plane and make it to the top and live. And he was a bit of a hero. But we have this picture of my mother kind of sitting by the bedside crying, and I just know she's begging him to please go out to sea. You're a Navy man. Go to sea. Get out of the sky. But we lived in Japan, and my mother took up Japanese flower arranging, which is called ikebana, and it's a true art. It's not just plunking flowers in a vase. It involves texture and color and balance, just, you know, as an art. And that defined my mom as I was growing up.
And there are five children in your family.
Yep.
So you're, in addition to everything you just said, your mother was raising five kids with little help from your father, who was pretty busy as a Navy man.
They were, the naval officers or Navy men were often stationed or out to sea for 6 months at a time. So mom was raising us in Japan on her own. That's when she took up flower arranging. And I have a chapter in the book that muses even a mother with five children can be lonely. Mm-hmm. I mean, you think not, but there were five of us all off to school. And what mom's day was just a series of repetition, series of kind of house cleaning and rarely stopping to take the time to appreciate the beauty of nature and what was going on around her. There's in that chapter, I talk about her doing that. But I think Ikebana was her release for her spirit. It was an expression of herself, her artistic expression.
Yeah. And I just took my family to Japan over Christmas.
Awesome.
It was so great. And it's really meditative also, the flower arranging. Like the whole country actually, the way it behaves, I felt was in this, there was a level of deliberateness that I was not familiar with from my own life.
Right.
And I can imagine how soothing it would be for a woman with little control to go into a place where she could very quietly, very methodically put something together and complete a project. Like, I feel like motherhood, we're always looking for something that we can finish because it offers so little. There's no little culminating events in motherhood.
You know, it's an interesting thought because I always insist Ikebana is an art. It's not quite a hobby. It's an art. So if anybody's picked up painting or creating clothing, whatever it is, and you look at it as an art, it becomes exponentially an expression of yourself. Mm-hmm. It becomes a way that you begin to see the world. Mm-hmm. And so it's, you know, I suppose you could say gardening too, but there's something about Ikebana. It came down from the Buddhist masters mm-hmm. and their contemplation of nature and their contemplation of flowers. In fact, Eckhart Tolle says, and I thought, I had just picked up one of his books, and I thought, this is really interesting, where he said that when the human being first took a flower home, ancient man first took a flower home and appreciated it, that it opened up the ability for the human being to experience joy and love in a different way than previously, because it wasn't utilitarian. The flower is not utilitarian mm-hmm. at all. So they took it home, kind of inviting art into the home, and that cracked open a way of seeing the world as an artist. And you're thinking, well, you know, ancient man, this is what he's talking about. Right. And I love that it's about appreciation of beauty in nature.
Yeah.
So that's what she would do over there. It also gave her community. It gave her lots of people to kind of talk to. But she didn't want to be part of the gossip. She didn't want to be part of all the ladies gossiping on base or whatever was going on with the naval wives on base. She wanted to appreciate the Japanese culture and just take it in and bring it home to us. Mm-hmm. And so that's what she was doing with Ikebana.
And you were there for 3 years?
Mm-hmm.
And then you came back, and where'd you go end up?
We came back, and we went to Texas for a brief period of time. Then we ended up in Maryland. And that was a real culture shock, because in the military, in our school, there were all different kinds of kids, you know, all races, all levels, all officers, enlisted men. And then to come back to Texas, it was a little bit shocking. Because they had, my school was almost all white. I remember there was one black girl who sat by herself at a long table and at lunch, and no one sat with her. And it was just so strange. And the school also had corporal punishment. It would smack your hands with rulers, and you're like, what is going on here? We'd been in this wonderful military school with all these students. It was completely bizarre. And, of course, yeah. I made friends with the girl, but we were only there for 6 months. And then we went to the Washington, D.C. area, which was because my father was working at the Pentagon. And that was a whole other awakening, being in the Washington, D.C. area. There was a busing and a lot of things that went on in the school that required a readjustment. And what the book does is it takes you, you know, it starts you in Japan, or it actually starts you on May Day mm-hmm. when we lived in Garden Grove, California. And it takes you then to Japan, and it talks about how my mother exploded into this woman that I'll always remember. She just really acquired a voice there mm-hmm. that maybe she'd had traces of, but there, exposed to the sensuality, as you were just saying with you and your kids, exposed to this sensual world, she became a different kind of woman. Mm. And then it takes you back to Maryland. So it takes you through the ages of life, but it's not linear, because I tell you in the very beginning, she has Alzheimer's. I'm not trying to tell you it's a surprise, and I'm not trying to write the book like it's a progression of her demise into it. It's really not an Alzheimer's book. It's a sort of mother-daughter adventure book.
Yeah.
But Alzheimer's is there. So you query, as I query every day, do I have it? What happens later in life when life doesn't go as you expect it? How does loss affect life? And so I really wanted you to understand where we came from and what we had and the richness of what we had, and then think about what happens when that's lost.
Yes, and also just the very nature of a thing. Like if a woman is capable in a moment and then she can't remember how she did it a moment later, is she no longer capable? Or like the difference between, or the things that affect, what is memory undoing, and what is it that we just think it's undoing, but actually she's there in that, in the present moment. So tell us, how did she know that Alzheimer's was her fate?
Well, I'll tell you first, it's Alzheimer's, I think of it as, I cannot make lemonade from these lemons. There's nothing good about it. And so I can't say, on the bright side, Kelly.
Yeah.
there's not a bright side. That doesn't mean you can't find joy. That doesn't mean I can't find purpose. I try to repurpose the pain to something positive by writing the book. But it is the, if memory is a companion, I've come to think of it as a companion, that it's supposed to be there for you when you are older. Not just a companion, it's a validator. It validates your very life. Yes, I did this. Yes, I have these children. Yes, I was in Japan. Yes, look at my flower arrangements. Yes, look at my degrees that I got. Yes, look at, that was me. And guess what? All those things added up, and that makes my life really beautiful. Mm-hmm. And yes, I had love, and yes, I had compassion and care. Suddenly, you don't know who you are or what you are other than what people tell you. My mother said to me once, and I put that in there, people tell me all the time that I used to do these things. And I said, how do you feel about that, Mom? She said, well, it's interesting because they knew me, so they knew I did them, so that's good. And just in that very sentence, it's like the bottom continually falls out. But you can't live that way. You can't live with the bottom always falling out, and it's your mother. So how did my mom accept it? I think with the same grace that she accepts so much of the rest of her life. In the early moments of understanding, and I think each of us kids in the family, one of my sisters is here today with us, Stephanie, who lives at in the Presidio here, I think in the early understandings, each of us understood it at a different point. Mm-hmm. Mom traveled a lot with me, and we had a very our own specific relationship. And so I understood that she was having memory problems because she told me. She would say, Marcia Gay, I'm just forgetting the simplest of things. And I think the same way I do for myself, it's like, Mom. You know, that's called CRS. My girlfriend told me it's called can't remember shit, right? That's what that is, Mom. And every mother in the world has it, so you're fine. Because I walk into the room and I'm like, what did I come in here for? And then I retrace the entire house and the kids are just waiting. She'll figure it out in a minute. You know, they're just waiting for me to figure out what the hell I'm doing in the house. And so
it's like when you open the microwave and you're like, oops, that's the tea from yesterday that I was heating up that I apparently really wanted.
Exactly, right. Apparently. Whoops. Didn't need it. So I dismissed it in the same way that I think we do dismiss. Sure. It's just memory. You can't remember. You put your keys, get a tile, you know, all of that, which I have. So I dismissed it.
That's a little product placement for tile.
Oh, I guess it is, but I didn't mean it to be.
Yeah.
I could do a lot of the memory product placements if you really want to know. So
do you think at any level that you didn't want to think about?
At every level.
Yeah.
Because it was her biggest fear. So to validate her biggest fear, and it would have been my biggest fear for her. The thing is, look, every disease is a fear, right? But let's say cancer, which there's so many cancer survivors and so many cancer fighters, and you still have your voice with cancer. So you're fighting it. You have a community. You have your voice. You know what you're fighting. You lose your voice with Alzheimer's, and your voice becomes your children's voice or the storytellers around your voice. So that's really hard. It wasn't until a couple, but also not just denial, it looks like aging. the early on, it looks just like aging and distraction. So it's truly hard to tell. We suggested that she be tested. Different ones of us had different opinions about what she might have had. But she was traveling with me when the penny dropped for me was an incident with passports when Mom kept putting her passport in her purse and then forget where she just put it, which, by the way, has happened to me before. So it wasn't a great alarming situation. But on the second and third time it happened, the anguish with which she was frantically trying to remember where it was in her purse and get it and bring it out to make sure she had it and put it back again stunned me a little. And I had offered her, I'll just take it, Mom, like I take my kids' passports all the time. I'll just take the passport and I'll take care of it. And she was vehement that I not do that. And then I began to understand, oh, she wants to put the moments together in this second here to where the string of thoughts slides together and there's no gap in between. And she knows she just put it in there because she remembers she just put it in there. She doesn't need to triple check that she put it in there. And then maybe a couple months later, I don't do time really well. I don't track time really well. I don't think about her in stages. But I can tell you some months later, we were at a premiere and I'm with my hair makeup people, Richard Marin and Collier Strong, who knew me and Mom from the Oscars. They had made us up in 2001. So this was, I want to say, maybe 2005, but it might have been 2007. In the book, I made sure it was clear, but I don't remember them so clearly.
CRS.
There you go. Or, who knows, right? I haven't had that test yet. But anyway, we had itineraries printed out, and my mom had gone. We'd said, come back with the, let's just say, the red dress for tonight. And it was the press junket that night. And so Mom left, and she came back down the hall with a black dress. And we were like, no, Mom, go back and get the other one. And she came back with the wrong dress again. And I couldn't understand. I had told my hair makeup people Mom had been having memory loss. She was a little bit fragile. And she but we've been traveling. She was distracted. And they were like, uh-huh. When she came back the second time, they kind of looked at me, and I could see again the look on Mom's face is a bit blank, and I thought, but she has the schedule in her hand. Why can't she compute? Just read the schedule, Mom. She can still read. If it says Tuesday is this dress and Wednesday is this dress. And then I realized she didn't remember what day it was.
Oh.
She didn't know if we'd had the night before and if she'd already experienced the night before and we were on to the second day. And she'd gambled that we were on to the second day, but we were still on the first day. And so I left to take her down the hall. And when I came back, it was so sad. The trash can was so much more full with tissues, and my hair and makeup guys' noses were red because they'd been crying because they knew my mom and they knew what a vital, beautiful woman she was. And they'd now been, crying and blowing their nose. And they just looked at me when I came in like, this is a road ahead of you now. And it was still several years before she was actually diagnosed with Alzheimer's. She had early onset dementia and then Alzheimer's. And it was definitely her worst fear. And it's all of our worst fear, I think, on some level, because the statistics are heinous.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's like 5.7 million people, I think, and 45 billion people worldwide. And they say when you're 80, you have a 50-50 chance. This one killed me because it really puts it in perspective. They say every 65 seconds, someone comes down with Alzheimer's. 65 seconds. And in the next 30 years, that's going to change to every 30 seconds, someone comes down with Alzheimer's if we don't find the cure.
And it goes on forever. I mean, it's such a challenging thing. Having had cancer, having watched people die of cancer, it's so preferable, not that we should be ranking these things, but like it's just so difficult to have something that's chronic, that never ends. The idea of a beginning and a middle and an end is very different than the beginning of something that just runs all the way out for 15 years. How long has your mom?
She's been with it 10 years, right, Steph? A little over 10 years. And the end is abject loneliness. Abject loneliness. And so that is that's what we try to do as caregivers, is keep her not lonely. keep her doing art, keep her comforted, holding hands, being this power of touch, the power of love. And again, I know it's such a sad subject. I promise you the book has...
The book's really beautiful.
The book has laughter and joy and some really, you know, fun, the New Zealand stories, yeah. some really fun stories in it about my mother and me. Yeah. But if it's going to change the world, if it's going to be a gift to the people, we have to talk about Alzheimer's. And I remember writing it. There was this time when I'd written the fun stuff in the beginning.
Yeah, the easy stuff.
The easier stuff, right? And the youth. And I had this neighbor, Alvin Sargent, I was telling you about. He's a screenwriter who wrote Ordinary People, Paper Moon, Julia, Spider-Man. Amazing screenwriter. He was 85, and I had a tremendous crush on him. I still do. he is the one who said to me, go home and write for 20 minutes at a time. And I did. And so he kind of inspired me to write the book. And he also said, take the cap off, which you do this. So, I mean, this is just like, I so love your writing. But he said, take the cap off, March, because I was trying to control everything. But I didn't want it to be like, in 1959, I was born. Right. I'm just like, I'm boring myself talking about that.
Yeah.
So I wanted, and as soon as he said, take the cap off, suddenly my mother was flying in the sky at times, or she was holding hands with the moon. And when we were on a flight over to Japan and she's holding hands with the moon, I thought, well, that feels more organic to me. That feels like how I'm thinking. That feels how I'm writing, is in metaphor and kind of a lyricism feels more right to me. So that's how I wrote it. But then I had to get to the end, and there had been some ugly stuff. I had been divorced, and I didn't take it. Like, there's some women, I admire them. They're like, they never look ugly. They never cry when they never look ugly when they cry. Yeah. And they'll be like, I kind of admire them, maybe not really. But they, they'll say things like, you know, one door closed and another door open. And that wasn't me. I was a heaping puddle on the floor with snot rolling out of every possible nose. I mean, I was heartbroken, and I believed that marriages last forever, and certainly that mine would. And so my mom had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's. I was in the middle of a divorce, and I was finishing homeschooling my kids, and everything was, you know, making us go, wait, who are we? So in the face of loss, who are we? In the face of when you can't define yourself anymore by the things around you, like houses. I think about those people who lose their houses and fires and earthquakes, and they live there forever. And suddenly, who are they when you don't have those definitions? And I stopped writing. The book was due out last Mother's Day, and I just stopped writing. It was supposed to be a Mother's Day gift to my mom. And I couldn't. And I knew it had to be ugly if I was going to write it. It had to be ugly, like if I'm going to play a character, I'm going to play what's ugly about them, because then we'll recognize ourselves, I think, in them. But I stopped, and then I got really pissed at myself again. Being pissed at yourself is such a great motivator on some level. I would just...
from Academy Award winning actress Marcia Gay Harden. Yell at yourself every now and then.
Occasionally. My dad had this phrase where he'd always go, pull yourself up by the bootstraps, Marcia Gay. And I'd be like, what the hell are bootstraps, Dad? Right. Like, I wear high heels, but right. I'll pull myself up by those if I have to. And it would always be that kind of a thing where you can sit around and wallow, and sometimes you have to, but then you absolutely have to. What is that cliched wonderful saying where success isn't about whether you fell down, it's about
how you get back
up. So I would think these wonderful little cliche meditation books, and eventually, you know, got back up and finished writing the book and wrote all the ugly parts, and that was the hard part to write.
You were very generous about showing yourself being impatient or stingy or irritated, because I think with long-term conditions, it is totally impossible to be the caretaker with constant grace.
Right.
And I think it's really kind of gutsy.
You're the master of it.
Yeah, but I'm not Marcia Gay Harden. Like, nobody, I mean, nobody has ideas about me being a wonderful person. Like, you know what I mean? Like, they probably have you on a pretty big pedestal. And so I just thought it was really generous in that way that you were showing that stuff. Was it hard for you to show yourself being snippy or...
The snippy part wasn't as hard because it was the heartbroken part. I didn't want people to know
about
that I had been hurt. you know, that was the hard part. I wanted to seem like a strong warrior, and I didn't want to seem needy. Oh, is there anything worse than being needy, right? We hate seeming needy. And so there I was being as needy as hell. But the snippy part felt normal to me because I feel like every mother, every woman can understand. People, you understand the moment that you're impatient with your parent. Yeah. You understand that moment when you're like, just come on. Like, I was living in New York City. Have a lot of you visited New York?
Yep. Yeah.
So you know how if you're walking down Times Square and you dare to stop in the middle of Times Square, you get mowed down by everybody in Times Square. Right. And my mother would want to stop and take a picture and look, and I'd be like, come on, Mom, we got to go. And I liked it. That's the real admission. I liked the espresso energy. I liked the speed. I liked honking at other cars when I would drive in New York City. I just figured it was communication. Right. And I'm like, move it. The light changed. And, yeah. And so that makes me feel, made me feel good. And I felt powerful, I think. Jaywalking. I'm meant to jaywalk.
You know what? I like jaywalking.
I love jaywalking. I personally think it's more safe than in Santa Monica. They have those lights that change, and then people just walk across the street without a care in the world. They don't even look to the right or the left to see if a car is there because the light changed and there are pedestrians and there they go. But hello, if a truck pulled up and stopped for a second, you don't see it. I mean, I've almost killed people, and you think, you know, jaywalk when the cars aren't coming. That's right. How you get across that street. So I would be snippy with my mother for sure about things like just move it. Or there was this story in New Zealand when we're in. Should I tell that?
Yeah, tell the story.
Okay, so we're in New Zealand, and I had before New Zealand, I had been dating a bagpiper.
As one does. Who hasn't?
Who occasionally wore a skirt while bagpiping.
But did he wear underwear in his skirt is really the
question.
That's
for me to know, Kelly. Yeah.
Tell you what, you'll sell more copies.
Let's just say occasionally no underwear because the gift was we were going to go to New Zealand. I had to go back to do some looping on this film. And we were going to go, and I was 100% sure I had it planned. He was going to propose to me on the heaths of New Zealand, in between playing the bagpipes, and we were going to get married. I was already in my 30s. I was practically a spinster, and so I was sure that was going to happen, but he broke up with me conveniently right before the trip. To me, and I could take nobody on the trip, although you could still change tickets at the time in somebody's name. And I was sobbing, as I want to do, as you can tell, when relationships end. And I'm with my therapist, and she says, well, why don't you just invite your best friend? I'm like, my best friend's my mother. I can't invite my mother. It won't be romantic at all. So the entire trip, I punished my mother because I invited my mother. So I punished her the whole trip for not being my bagpiping boyfriend with no underwear. And
and a big diamond ring.
And a big ring. And at one point, we're driving around looking for directions, and we're, you know, just map days. It's no GPS. It's nothing. And we're trying to read these maps, and all the signs are written in Maori, which means they're really hard to pronounce. And then sometimes in Maori, the WH you have to pronounce with an F if it's a word. So like Whanganui would be Fanganui. But if there was a K in the word, it sounded like a curse word. So Mom wouldn't say it. So she would only pronounce it like with the American. And I was like, Mom, it's a Maori word. Yeah. You're not cursing. And everything she did got on my nerves, and everything I did got on her nerves. And then at some point we passed this sign that we were supposed to turn at, and she goes, oh, there goes Wakapapa. And I'm like, what, mother? She goes, okay, Fuck-a-papa! Fuck-a-papa! And she was like, and we got out of the car, and we had like, we were laughing so hard, we had to pee behind the rental car, like with the sheep in the background. And then we go back to the hotel later, and she's like reading all her beautiful flower books, and she's on the bed in a lavender nightie, and she has all these lessons, and she just kind of makes a way for me in her little garden of books, and I crawl in, and she teaches me all these lessons about flowers. But the killer is when she takes my hand and she says, don't worry, honey, you will find love. Mm-hmm. And you're like, she got that. Yeah. That's why I was being all those a little bitch. She got that. That's why I was doing that, because I was so afraid that I was not just not going to find love, but that I wasn't worthy of love. Mm. You know, because if he broke up with me, then I wasn't worried. I must in that thing that we do, and it takes a while to recover. And so she was. That's who she was. And so writing those parts seemed honest to me. Mm-hmm. I know my kids will be like, "Mom, I think I'm the least helicopter mom in the world," but apparently I'm even a little bit of a helicopter mom to them. So I know when they write whatever they write, there's going to be big passages about me sneaking reading their diaries because I did.
So did I.
Oh, thank you. We're supposed to. Yeah. So I know that there'll be things like that, and that's honest. But it was the other part that was a little bit hard.
Yeah. I think it's interesting about moms. Whenever somebody in our group of friends says, "Oh, my mom's coming next week," everyone goes, "Oh." And I think, why? Why is that the reaction?
I'm so glad you said that.
That's what's coming for us. Is that what George is going to say when I come all the way across the country to see her when I'm 75 right. years old? Is she going? Are her friends going to be like, "Oh, how long is she staying?"
Right. Or the mother-in-law?
Do you
thing.
Need me to come over? You know what I mean?
Well, I did say even in the book, I hate that mother-in-law thing too. I absolutely hate it when the one of the spouses says, "You know, my parents are coming," and the reaction of the other spouse is like, the in-laws. And I would say I was always grateful to my ex that he didn't have that about my mother. He embraced my mother. He loved the fact that I wanted her to travel with us all the time. It was like a little threesome. She was always there, and we pretended like we were bringing her to help us with the kids whenever I'd go someplace, but I always hired people at the hotel or wherever to help us with the kids because I just wanted mom to be there for the parties and for the fun of it all. And I was really grateful. That was a good thing about my ex. He loved my mom.
Yeah. Well, that makes it hurt even more, actually.
Right. I interview my kids' boyfriends now, so just it's a good part of the puzzle.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Your mom made you try out for your first play.
She did. She did. I was living in Washington, D.C., and I had graduated from University of Texas. And I'd been to Greece, to Germany, then Texas in schools. And so I'm living in D.C., kind of getting myself together because I don't want to move straight to New York, but I know I'm eventually going to. And my mother, I've been singing at the Gaslight Club, which was
remember? You were a Gaslight Girl.
I was a Gaslight Girl. So
these guys even
what you had to wear. It was like a private gentleman's club, but it wasn't a strip club.
But it's pretty damn close.
It was not close.
There were fishnets involved.
There were fishnets and chokers, but you kept your clothing on. And your hair had to be pretty. But it was like you served drinks in high heels and fishnets. There was like a dining room downstairs. But you had to sing at the piano. So there was a piano. I've never been to a Playboy club, but I don't think this piano's there. But the little outfit you wore was like a little like Gunsmoke kitty Gunsmoke thing, velvet meets Playboy outfit with fishnets and high heels. And then you had to go up and you had to be at the piano and sing. But I'm not a great singer. So I had one song that I knew I could hit the notes to, but not elongate the notes to, just hit the notes to, just be like, "I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter," and I would let it, like some people go letter, you know, like that's how you're supposed to sing it. And I'd be like, "Hitty compy, when am I done you know. So one day these billionaires gave me $100 bill not to sing. All right, so you get the picture. So I'd gone out to my mother's house and my mom and dad's, and I was having breakfast with them. And mom pulled out this little article, and she from the newspaper. She said, "Look, honey, there's auditions for I Ought to Be in Pictures at the old theater of Alexandria." It was like the little theater. And I said, "Oh, mom, it's a musical. I'm not going to audition for it." She's like, "No, honey, I don't think it's a musical. It's a Neil Simon play." And of course, I know everything. I'm like, "Yeah, mom. I know it's a Neil Simon play, but it's a musical. It's not a play. It's a musical. I'm not going to audition." And it turns out we went back and forth until she said, "Well, if it is a musical, just don't sing." Like, "Ma, we called. It wasn't a musical. It was a play. I auditioned with the play. I got the part. My parents came to see it. I got good reviews by the critics. I made them into a big brag sheet that I took everywhere. Anybody who wanted to hire me for anything, I'd be like, look what the critics said, okay? And I showed them all. And eventually when I was in New York, I showed this brag sheet to people in New York. And it's kind of how I ended up getting my first jobs. So I can literally trace it back to that moment when mom was just going, go on, honey, go on. And it's, in a way, it's the lesson is do the things you're afraid of. Do the things you think you can't do.
I want to read something that I thought was so interesting as a mom. Like, I took note of this, which is that they're talking, going back and forth about whether she should do the audition. And she said, in the silence that ensued, I could feel and resented my mother's longing for me. She ran her fingers through her soft black curls and smiled, neither pushy nor disapproving, only hopeful. It irritated me that she thought I was stronger than she was. And I feel that sometimes with my kids that are like, give me room to not be ready for the thing you think I'm ready for.
Yes.
And yet, she nudged you just right. Well, I mean, your whole life unfolded from there. And maybe it was going to unfold from anyway. But maybe you got a little jump on it because she saw something.
I think so. And I think the irritation was also I didn't want to see her as less strong than me. Because that had happened also in New Zealand. Suddenly I'm leading the way in the airport. And I'm, you know, she would ask me things like, well, when we get to the restaurant, honey, do you think they'll have coffee? And I think, I don't know, Ma. I've never been there. Or she would just, questions like that. It was like this weird thing that would happen between us. And I felt so alone in my irritation. But that's one of the reasons why I like talking to people. They're like, yes, we've been through that too. Yeah. And ultimately, I realized it was sort of, I call it the great migration of age, where we realize we see better. You know, I don't pay a bill anymore that my kids don't pay and sign at the restaurants because I can't see the damn thing. Mm-hmm. So at first, I know they didn't like seeing me as losing my eyesight. Because that means I'm getting old. That means I'm not there for them in every way. But now they understand that mom, you know, is aging. There's ultimately a migration before the ultimate caretaking where we're the stronger ones. Where they defer to us. And I wasn't ready for it. Hadn't expected, maybe we never expect it. It comes upon us by surprise. And suddenly you go, oh, I'm an adult. Mm-hmm. I'm an adult and they're aging and they're still my mom, but I'm an adult. And also, we can be friends. That was the other thing. That was later. We could be friends if we didn't have to be mother-daughter. I wanted to smoke and curse, like I loved to do. And she...
We got to go out.
We got to go on. I'm a big potty mouth.
Yeah.
Yeah. MF is my favorite word.
Yeah.
Ever.
It's so versatile, isn't it?
It's really versatile. Yeah. I say, if you drop a hammer on your toe, what is the first thing that comes out of your mouth? And that is your go-to curse word, right?
Right.
For my father, it was, goddamn son of a bitch. So there were a couple of them, right? And everything was that. Because he's like he said, he was a salty old naval officer. Moms? Stephanie, what is moms? Did she have a curse word? Damn, she didn't. My mother didn't have a curse word.
Yeah.
Yeah. Serious, serious.
But you are a lot alike. Like at one point in it, you say you have a lot in common with your mom. And I wondered if layered in that was this fear that you might have the same story might unfold for you.
Well, that's
so how do you process that part
of it? Yeah, that's a good question. That's the fear now. Because I feel like I'm so like my mom down to body type, down to, you know, a bunion or something. I mean, it's like down to the my cold feet.
Oh,
right?
I have cold feet too.
I have cold feet. Oh my God, we should go out. So I do fear it. So I did that. Has anyone done the 23andMe? The 23andMe thing? Nobody in this whole room?
In San Francisco we would have some, yeah.
Yeah, so it's the genetic testing where you can figure out your ancestry. And, of course, I was totally hoping I had, like, African-American and Spanish and Native American Indian in me. No, I'm as WASP as they come. But you can also – you make a choice. You pay a little bit more for the choice. You can make a choice to see your medical genetic history potential. So they ask you, are you sure you want to know? Which, of course, like at first you were, but then they ask you like, wait a minute,
right.
Maybe I don't. But I did want to know because one of the things that's happened with mom's Alzheimer's is it's allowed me to become an advocate and an activist for it. And I thought you better put your money where your mouth is, MGH. And if you're going to – I do advocate for early testing. And I'm one who would want to know. Totally respect that a lot of people wouldn't want to know, but I do want to know because it would be a gift to my children to know. Mm-hmm. And so I did the 23andMe and I didn't have the gene. It's called the APOE gene. I don't have it. Doesn't mean I won't get it, I don't know if my mother has it. I'm going to have her do the testing too. But or maybe she's already done it. I'm not sure. But anyway, I don't have it. And so the next thing to do would be to the scan, the brain scan, to see. But I'm afraid of it every day. I wake up anxious every morning, mm-hmm. not just for me, but for my mother. I go to bed, think she's the last thing I think about at night. She's the first thing I think about in the morning. And part of it is guilt. I don't think one can have an Alzheimer's family member and not feel guilty just because you couldn't take it away, just because you couldn't alleviate, you weren't there. You live in another state. Literally, that you didn't give up your life to be there for them in their life. That's what you feel. I mean, you gave up tons when your dad got sick, even with cancer, mm-hmm. right? You gave up months and months to go be, and mm-hmm. your family said it's okay. Mm-hmm. But there was no end in sight with this, and you can't do it. So guilt, I mean, all of those things play a part in understanding how to go move forward.
There's also the complexity of often there's financial considerations, and there's also with five kids, you probably ended up with five distinct opinions about next steps, about the sequence of events, about the pace of care.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that for all the people who are listening, thinking, oh my God, but I got my sister to worry about, and my brother, and they want my dad to live in Philly, and they want my dad to live in Baltimore, and somebody else wants him to come to California. And it's just so riddled with complexity and dynamics.
It's true. Death tears families apart anyway, and Alzheimer's absolutely can tear a family apart. And all the things you said, people live in different places. People have different opinions. One person usually ends up being the main caregiver. And that did occur in our family too. We had to make financial choices to, because you don't know how long it's going to last. Mom has been living with it for over 10 years now. So we had to make financial choices to move her out of the home she had been living in, to move her into another family home. And the main takeaway was that what always would guide us was, is she safe? Is she safe? Is she safe? Is she cared for? Is she loved? Is she safe? There were different opinions about what we should do.
Of course.
And they were, they do create conflict, right? But you just have to keep asking yourself that question. And that's why I'm such an advocate also for that really important window that comes from early detection. Because in that window, the Alzheimer's patient and the family give the patient the opportunity to be in charge of their own destiny. And that's the window when you suspect something might be going on with one of your loved ones, even though it's the scariest thing in the world, you want to test them so that you can make sure, if they have it, if you know where it's going, that you can say to them those horribly difficult questions. How do you want to live? How do you want to die? At what point are you okay with being in a home? How are we going to handle the finances? Who is your durable power? Who is your medical power? Who is going to be making decisions for you when you can no longer make decisions? Now, they can tell you that so that you know at this moment in time, the kids are released from that burden of being the thought. It's almost like this moral thought in a way, because what the parent wanted, you feel, is on moral grounds, and you release yourself of that. And then because it's what they wanted. They said they wanted it. It's right there. And, you know, we can make judgments within there what they said they want. But that's why I wanted to do that for my kids. I didn't want them to have to go, no, she would want this. And no, she'd want this. You know, I wanted them to go, guys, at a certain point, if I haven't moved to Oregon, you know, if I have it, then you can feel comfortable putting me in a home. And if I know that I have it, I might even pick the home where I want to be and structure the finances so that I could be there.
Yeah.
The scary thing, we were talking about this a little bit in the back, is that, you know, if Medicare and Medicaid don't remain part of our American society for our seniors and ultimately for us, I can only use one word for it. We're fucked. It's fucked. Because the people who are going to be financially responsible most likely will be women in their 50s. There's a huge propensity of women in their 50s who are divorced, so their finances have already shifted, and they'll be the caretakers for the parents, and there's not money to take care of it, so the parent's going to come live with them. And so it's a very, with no money. I mean, it's to look at the baffling situation of the finances, because you mentioned it is expensive. It's expensive to have caregivers. It's expensive to give up your job to be a caregiver. It's difficult to raise your children and be a caregiver if your kids have already gone off. I mean, the Alzheimer's Association says they don't like kids being the caregivers to their parents, because the kid, you oftentimes it alters your relationship with them, and you literally give up your life. So they like the idea that you could hire caregivers who are trained, or now there's more cutting edge places where you can, there are homes where you can put your parent. But when we were looking at some of the Alzheimer's care units, they were, you know, you were 100% sure that the patient was drugged, then they were sitting kind of to the side or playing with balloons. And we said, absolutely not for my mom. One of the places we looked at had just had an incident of elder abuse, and we were said, no way in hell. So she's now beautifully, comfortably safe and in a beautiful little home on a lake that my grandfather had built in the 60s. She's surrounded by love. She has one sister who cares for her a lot. She has another sister who was just down there doing art with her and painting and doing watercolors at a table. Steph and I feel guilty that we're not there more, that we visit when we can. My brother's down there. So it does tear people apart, but eventually you have to come together just for their safety.
Yeah, and to your point, to underline your point, this is why early detection is super, super, super valuable. There are some great moments, like the song Tequila.
Oh, yeah.
So yes. Will you talk a little bit about music and the role that it can play in terms of like reaching into a Alzheimer's patient and stirring something?
That's a good point. You've probably heard that music can spark memory in an Alzheimer's patient. Familiar music from the time when they were listening to, and it does make me think. My mother, the beautiful thing, my mother hasn't changed. The essence of my mother is the same. She's still this graceful, beautiful lady, and we're lucky because a lot of times patients can go off into aggression or they can go off into lascivious behavior. For instance, my mother did not. But she always loved music. She's not now listening to AC/DC, right? That's why, you know, something's changed for mom. And so when we were kids, Kelly's talking about an incident when my dad would put on jazz all the time. And so before he would go off to sea, he'd put on jazz. And I wrote about a time, a memory that I had of, we would go to Taco Bell the day before he would be going out to sea for 6 months at a time, because it was our treat to eat out. You know, military families don't make tons and tons of money. And so mom made, she's a mother. She made the meals for all of us. So we'd go to Taco Bell, and then we'd come home, and he'd put on kind of Mexican music, and he would right, and we would dance around the house. And so one of the songs we danced to was da 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 Tequila, and we would play hide and seek, and we'd whip these napkins around our head and dance Tequila, and it was really fun. And so years later, I'm now visiting my mom in Texas, and I brought these little Bose speakers, and I've put in some music, and I'm playing the song Tequila, and she kind of tequila on the word, like in time with it, she remembered something and she sings it, because it was a Wes Montgomery version, right? So the words are different. And then later I play Pachelbel's Canon for her, which she always loved, Pachelbel's Canon. And she's kind of astonished at the Bose speakers, which I've just explained to her what they are. And then I have to explain to them again that they're these wonderful Bose speakers, and she's listening to the music, and she does seem to spark to, not really memory, I'm going to say. She doesn't really go, oh, I remember when that played. But she lifts out of a place that she is. It's like maybe if there's a blankness, she lifts out of the place that she is. And the very last chapter of the book is, or the last moment of the book, we're driving, I'm with our caregiver, and we're driving to church. And this Sarah Vaughan comes on. Sarah Vaughan song comes on, and it's about how seasons change and how hummingbirds fly. And in the story, mom kind of leaves and goes up into the clouds with some angels, and Tony Kushner's angels. Yeah. And while the Sarah Vaughan song is on, and she'll occasionally just remember one word and whisper it and seem to connect to some memory of that. But when they've really done real therapy with people with music, they're a little bit earlier, right? So there's a certain point when even music doesn't reach them. There was a great CBS, did anybody see it? The CBS 60 Minutes episode. And it was really pretty devastating, because I remember in it there was a moment when the woman was touched by music, and then there's a moment when it goes past. So mom is still like where she can be touched by music.
Yeah. Will you tell us your Oscar story?
Yes. Yes, I will.
I thought you'd never ask.
Well, I hope it's not too long, because the parts that are it starts with me thinking about when I first told my parents that I'd been nominated, because I didn't think I'd been nominated. Pollock was a really small film, but there's a lot of buzz about it. So I'd called home, and remember I've told you my mother was a part of Japanese flower arranging groups, and they were called different chapters, and garden club groups. Well, she got all her news always from the garden club group. So I called home to say, Mom, I was nominated for an Academy Award. And she says, I know, darling, I know. Hold on. Because all the garden club had already told her.
Yeah.
So she goes, she hands the phone. She goes, here's your father. And Dad just goes, fan-fucking-tastic. Right? That's like his response. So that's my dad, this naval officer. So now I'm back in California, and Dad decides that he's going to design my dress. I'm like, what, naval officer turned dress designer? What's going on here? And he's like, I want you to wear champagne pink. And I'm like, Dad, I'm a size 8. I'm not going to wear champagne pink because I feel fat at a size 8. And he's like, no, you got to look elegant, damn it. I want you to look elegant. So my stylist, Jessica, says, give me the phone, Washa. Give me the phone, because she's over visiting. She's hearing me, like, going, Dad, I can't. I'm like clutching my stomach and feeling all my fat. And he's like, so she goes, give me the phone. She goes, hi, Captain. He's like, hello. And she says, so, oh, you're so right. She needs to look elegant. He's like, goddamn right. And she says, she needs, and champagne pink, what a great idea. And I'm like, I'm horrified. Champagne pink, no. And then she goes, listen, we're going to take care of her. She's going to look elegant. But, Captain, let me ask you something. Do you like cleavage? He's like, hell yes! And she's like, okay, she's going to look elegant with cleavage. So she designs this beautiful dress for me. Randolph Duke designed it. We go to the Oscars. We are we're wearing millions of dollars of jewels. We had been told that we could have $500,000 worth of jewels with no bodyguard. And then I was like, that's going to be plenty. $500,000. Are you kidding me? No bodyguard. We don't want a bodyguard. We want it to be just family. Right, Mom? And Mom's like,
Or as long as he stays in the background.
Right. In the background. And a diamond or two for me. She's like, well, to wear? Because, of course, you wear when you give them back at the end of the night. So then they get wind that the dress is really grand. And then the Harry Winston says, okay, she can have $1 million worth of diamonds with no bodyguard. And I'm like, Mom, we can have $1 million. We're in a fitting, right? There's bodyguards. They're showing us the jewels. There's dress designers. Everybody's in this little fitting. And I'm yelling over the partition, Mom, $1 million worth of jewels. No bodyguard. So we're good, right? No bodyguard. Mom's like, I know, a million. Because she's like, well, there needs to be some for me. And then she's pushing some around. She goes, and some for Stephanie, because Stephanie's coming down. Right? So we go, we look at him, and every time I put on a necklace and a ring, people gasp. And every time I take it off, they're like, I put it on, they gasp. And so at the end of the day, we get $4 million worth of jewels and a bodyguard. And we go through the Oscars. I win. I'm like the second one up. I win. I'm astonished. And here's something funny, is that when I won, it wasn't a pure moment. It wasn't a moment that you would imagine where it's just elation and you're walking up to the podium and you're like, da 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 da, I'm here. I won and I felt elated, and then I felt badly for the other actresses who didn't win. And then I was worried that maybe Nicolas Cage, who was giving me the award, hadn't wanted me to win. So, and then I was going to have to go up and get it from him, and what was his face going to look like? And then I was like, I'm really so glad that I'm here. And then I was like, what if Ed doesn't win? And I was wondering, did I hug all the right people? You know, my mind was just insecure as I was going up there, elated and insecure, elated and insecure. Yeah. So it wasn't pure. And I look out and I'm thinking, well, I want to see where my mom and dad are. And it wasn't hard, because my dad was standing up about four rows behind where I've been, with his arms over his head going, Bravo! Just literally yelling Bravo. Mom was trying to pull him down. I was praying that Spielberg wasn't sitting behind him, because I'd never get a job. And then at the end of the night, Dad has gone home. He wasn't feeling well. Mom and me and my lawyer are in the car, and my Thaddeus's name. And we were all going back to the hotel, and this chase ensues on the highway. I thought it was paparazzi for sure, because now I was famous. I had just won an Oscar, and I was thrilled with every bit of it. And my husband was filming it all. And then the bodyguard goes, it could be jewel thieves. At which point my mother began clutching at her jewels and going for the sunroof, ready to throw them out the sunroof.
Oh my.
saying, like, I want to live. I want to live. I'm like, Ma, it's paparazzi. I'm sure it's paparazzi. You know, because now I'm
famous, it's
right,
OJ.
Mom?
It's
right,
it's one of those.
And so we go all through this whole thing. And we end up, you know, pulling into a police station, and they jump on the jewel thieves, paparazzi. What were they? We never knew. We're like staring out the top of the sunroof. Mom covertly puts her earrings back on because we still had 3 minutes left to get to the hotel. So Cinderella was not going out without a splash. Oh. And we get to the hotel, and we take off our jewels, and the bodyguard says, by the way, it was paparazzi. And I'm like,
yeah.
And he says, they thought it was Russell Crowe. Hate him.
Oh my God. Okay. We have 11 minutes left, and I want to ask some questions that
sure.
the audience
great.
Wants to know. So I'm going to give you a little bundle
okay,
of questions,
great.
And then you can magically spin it into a single answer.
Okay, got it.
So one question is really interesting, which is, has being an actress helped you deal with all the difficult roles that you've been, that life has handed you? Hang on. Is there any evidence of anything that offsets the disease, Alzheimer's? Mm-hmm. Older people, especially women, are often ignored by the media and society. So any thoughts on how to change that? And how do you get people to have difficult conversations? Do you have any tips on how to get a family to have the difficult conversations that long-term care generally involves?
Okay, I'll jump in. There's a place called the Lou Ruvo Center in Las Vegas. It's a Frank Gehry building, and it's the cutting edge right now of Alzheimer's research, and it's also a hospital. And I was just there, and this great doctor named Dr. Cummings talked about this drug that kind of sounds like abracadabra, but that's not what it is, and they can't release the name of it yet. But it is the first drug that they're all really excited about. And when you see a bunch of stoic scientists getting excited about something, you know it's good. And they think it will cause a stasis with the Alzheimer's, the plaque spread. So we don't know the cause of it, and it won't cure it, but it may just stop it at a certain point. So that's really, really, really good news, and we continue to look for the cause of it. And if you go online, you can pull up any of the Broken Brain series, any of those brain talks right now, and they all talk about the gut-brain relationship. They talk, they call Alzheimer's diabetes 3, so there's a gluten and a sugar aspect to it. So you can do all that research, exercise. The bad news is you have to sweat. The good news is it helps. So those are things that we can do for it because it's moved so vastly, huge. The numbers are so huge. It has to be some lifestyle thing happening right now.
Right.
And that's why they say when you look at anthropological man, we grew up walking. We learned how to think walking 12 miles a day, basically a nomadic man did. And there was no sugar. And that's 50,000 years of body and genetic programming toward a certain way of learning in the brain, a certain way of moving in life, a certain way of eating. And it's only the last 200 and then 100 and then 50 that sugar's in everything. And we basically barely move. You know, mm-hmm. like this, eating a lot of sugar. So that makes sense when you think about it anthropologically. Our bodies are not trained to live like we do today. So that's one thing. And there is hope. Why more women than... Well, the question was why more women than men, but Maria Shriver did talk about that, and she does talk about that a lot. And sleep is a huge factor. And, of course, I think who's more sleep-deprived than young mothers? But that's just me armchairing it. More women in the media, I think moments like this. I think moments like what we're all doing. I think paying attention to women and understanding that our stories are absolutely important. And if you're a woman boss, making sure that you're doing equal pay and that we're advocating. And more than going, the marches were amazing, but then turning them into more, turning them into action. Mm-hmm. And then what was the first one, the first question?
Hard conversations, like how do you help
yeah.
a family?
Jump. All I can say is you jump in. And you can maybe get someone from the Alzheimer's Association. They will come to you, or you get a doctor, you get a therapist. You can set up mediators to come to you to have these conversations because they are hard, and families do think different things. And it's scary. People are scary. I know death is coming, and I've always not been really afraid to have the conversation. But I think that's the attitude. probably more of us are braver than we think we are if we're just confronted with how to be brave. Mm-hmm. So you jump in and you get a little help and support jumping in. There's some Kimberly Williams Paisley's book. It's called Where the Light Gets In. And she has a lot of really good resources at the end of it for associations. And, of course, the Alzheimer's Association is really good.
And then that very first question was about being an actress and playing all those roles the years. And does that prepare you for these moments, divorce and family struggles and Alzheimer's?
No. No.
You might be the only honest woman in the entire state of California. That's really...
Because it hurts just as bad. You know, I had beliefs just as much as the next person about my life. I never thought I was a statistic. You know, we had tragedy in the family early. My brother lost his children in a fire, and my mother gets Alzheimer's. I'm divorced. I never thought I was... We don't think we're statistics. Bad stuff happens to other people until it happens to you. Mm-hmm. And then you have to call on your own resources to rise to whatever is your true character. And your true character is how you deal with the problem, right? So I think acting maybe gives me a voice to speak about it. I'm comfortable translating feelings into dialogue and into, you know, that's what we do. It's all about language. And I do love language. So I am comfortable. We have to have our emotions on our surface so we can call on them in any second. So I do want to, I don't know if we gave up our 11 minutes, but you did make me think about something my mother said, which is a tremendous resource. And it's at the very end of the book. I had come to the end of the book and I was afraid to stop because I thought, what if there's some big reveal that I didn't know about and now the book is done and I don't have it. And so people won't know about it for her. And in some ways it was what I always knew, but it was an important reveal. So I say, Mom, whatever you're thinking about, I'm FaceTiming her. Whatever you're thinking about, Mom, I want you to tell me, whether it's gardening or flowers or sex or God or your family or love or whatever you're thinking about, just tell me. And I can see that she starts to say something and then she kind of stops. And I said, what? And she goes, God. We're not a super religious family. She goes, God. And I said, you're thinking about God? And she says, yes. And I said, what do you think about God? And she says, love. Love. It happens to everybody. The better the thoughts, the better the thinking. And that's Mom's way of saying that thinking beautiful thoughts, filling your brain with beautiful thoughts, is actually really good for the brain. And it really is. Anger and stress and friction and conflict and all, and staying on things and not giving, it's bad for the brain. And so that's my mother's gift in a way of what's good for the brain, and that she said it with the language that she had. Basically, you know, I'm like, okay, Oprah Winfrey, meet Guru, meet my mother.
Yeah.
Because right? God is love.
Yeah.
And fill your head with beautiful thoughts. And that was her gift.
Well, I tell you, this is a really beautiful book. And I can't recommend it highly enough for anyone who wants to reflect on their relationship with their mother or even with their own children. And especially, I think we should be buying extra copies and giving them to all the people we know who have a parent who has Alzheimer's right now, because it's really good company on that very long road. So, Marcia Gay Harden, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
I think there's a gavel moment now. It says it here. We also thank everyone here, as well as our audience on the radio, on television, on the internet. This program has been part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. We want to remind everyone that there are books outside, and we're happy to sign them. And I'm Kelly Corrigan, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.